Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to Irene Efren Podcast with me, Irene Efren. I interview women around Southeast Asia to bring their unique stories and experiences to empower other women in this region. In this episode, we have Frances Boden Afandi talking about widowhood in patriarchal society. She was born in Louisiana in January 1945, has lived all over Asia, and got a degree in anthropology and a hotel career. She then married David Afandi, a Sundanese man, in New York City. They moved to Bandung, Indonesia in 1982, and Frances is now a naturalized citizen of Indonesia. Now, David died in May 2013 at the age of 77 with the diagnosis of diabetes.
I was 68. David was 9 years older than I, and I was 68. Coincidentally, my mother was also widowed at 68, which is a coincidence, huh?
At that time, did you have children?
I did. We had two children. Gabriel, at the time, was 31, and Michael David was 25.
And were they in Indonesia at the time?
They were. Irene, it's difficult for me to even explain what happened the week that David died, because the following week, my son was to get married.
Oh,
Michael
goodness.
David was getting married. And David, at this point, was pretty sick. He was flat on his back and had been for 6 months, okay, refusing to go to the hospital. And so Gabriel was ready to fly for his brother's wedding, and people were ready to gather for the family wedding. It was the Thursday. He died on Sunday afternoon. It was the Thursday before that that I said to my husband, I have got to spend time on our son's wedding. This is a big day in his life, and I've been spending no time at all thinking about this wedding. And now I'm going to get a nurse to come in and be with you while I'm being mother of the groom. And he was able to understand what I was saying to him. So there were these wedding preparations going on at the same time as David was obviously failing. It was about maybe Friday of that weekend when David, in the very Indonesian way, said, Mau pulang, bade uwi. And I'd already learned what that meant. So I said to him, fine, you may. You may uwi. But you must wait for Gabriel. And so he seemed to understand what I was saying. And then it was, bade uwi, mau pulang. And I kept saying, you have to wait for Gabriel. Well, Gabriel was to arrive.
I
want to go home in Sundanese, yes. Gabriel arrived on Saturday. And we went to the airport to pick him up and bring him home. And he was coming, he thought, for the wedding. Well, of course he was coming for the wedding. He came, David saw him, and the next day David died. So then that evening, he died at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The people, the neighbors in our neighborhood came, were coming to visit in the afternoon, as they often did before Maghrib, to say hello and whatnot, because they knew he was sick. And so there was quite a crowd already in the garden when he expired, including his two kids. And the system took over at that point. I was kind of... Well, it was shocking, no matter what, because he'd been so sick. I think everybody but I actually knew that he was dying. I don't think that I realized that he was dying. I'd never been with anybody through that process before, so I didn't see the signs. But yeah, my kids were with me, which was great. We were, that evening, I would say we probably had about 200 people in the garden coming, and it was at that particular time that they, most of them had received invitations to the wedding. And so there were a lot of questions about the wedding. And then there were people that we hadn't invited who we invited verbally. Please come to the wedding. Please, you know, please come. So there were people that we hadn't expected. Ridwan Kamil came. Ridwan was a friend. He was running for mayor at this particular point. He wasn't the mayor yet. And so there were people that we said, oh, come to the wedding. And then we realized midweek that there was no way we could have a wedding this same week. And so we had to then spend, I spent the following Thursday canceling everybody. Don't come to the wedding. We're not going to have a wedding. There was, this was all going on. So Yes, there was a naji-naji every night. There were prayers every night from the people mm-hmm. in our kampung coming to pray because David had died. There were things going on with caterers and decorators and flower people for the wedding. Goodness. And this was the emotion. Mm-hmm. It was this crazy thing going on mm-hmm. between these two things to the point that it actually became funny. And we spent a lot of time laughing because it was almost hysterical. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was hysterical.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wedding was delayed, was canceled, in fact.
But it eventually happened.
Well, he eventually married, but not the same girl. That's a whole...
Okay.
Interview me again. That's another great story.
That's another story. Okay. So, you know, you said by now the system took over. I'm
yes.
very interested in that. What did you yeah. mean by that?
Well, the social situation, if you live in a kampung, and I do, Dagupojok is a kampung, there's an erte and there's an airway, and mm-hmm. we see these people every day. Mm-hmm. It's actually, Irene, you lived in the States. Mm-hmm. We talk about a democracy, we talk mm-hmm. about one man, one vote. It's not as democratic as Indonesia, where we actually vote for an erte, and we actually vote for an airway.
Okay.
And then from there on, it becomes this sort of other kind of representative government. But the erte airway system is perfect democracy. I mean, it really is.
Wow.
And I'm a great, great fan of this because I'm a fan of local government. I'm a fan mm-hmm. of local organization. The system taking over was the erte and the cadre of men at the masjid. People came, they brought whatever supplies they needed mm-hmm. to wash the body, to set him out, to have the prayers, to organize the mm-hmm. arrangements for the next day. I was largely unaware of most of it. Gabriel, my eldest child, was very much involved in this, mm-hmm. and so was Michael, my second child, both as Muslim men. And I think that they had some idea of what the system was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
Okay.
And as the widow, I had no responsibilities. And that's nice. In Sunda, they leave the widow alone. And mm-hmm. in fact, I remember several times David said, you don't have to go to the cemetery. Mm-hmm. Women don't have to go to cemeteries because it's deemed as too emotional. And that's not what Islam wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was actually cut out of all the decision making. I had no idea, which was good because you know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're not capable of making any mm-hmm. really informed decisions because mm-hmm. there's so much coming at you
right.
at the same time. And so this is the system, and this is the way the system's supposed to work. The whole idea of ritual and tradition
mm-hmm.
is to have a template
mm-hmm.
To help in times of chaos and times of mourning or happiness, weddings as well, and births of babies. And there's all these rituals that are in place to show us how to act and to guide us mm-hmm. in what we're doing. And that kicked in spades for me.
And you are grateful for that.
Extremely, extremely. Because I couldn't make a mistake. There, mm-hmm. I wasn't making any decisions, and I wasn't having to make a call on how I should behave or what I should do or how much food I should have or where people should sit.
Mm-hmm.
These decisions were all taken away from me by a budaya that had already figured it all out. I think this is the thing about COVID, which has disrupted all mm-hmm. these traditions. How do we celebrate a wedding? How do mm-hmm. we celebrate a death right now? Because we can't gather. We can't use these traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as an anthropologist, I'm very interested in that stuff
right,
as well.
Right. Well, you know, this might interest you, but in my experience, I actually found that I was a bit angry when these decisions were taken away from me.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to make or be a part of the decision making of whether what color was the coffin going to be.
I see.
When was the cremation going
I
to
see.
Happen, and what were we going to do with the dust
yes.
afterwards?
Yes.
And so that I might have disrupted some people's minds.
I'm sure you did.
Because they thought that, well, no, she's not in a healthy or in a mental state to make these decisions. But I was like, well, then what am I supposed to do,
right.
I guess.
Yeah. Well, we're cut slack. I think we're allowed to mourn for 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
Sunani's widow is allowed to mourn for 40 days. And so all the slack is cut. We don't have to make any decisions. I was happy enough to have all those decisions made.
Mm-hmm.
But again, my situation and your situation, quite different.
Mm-hmm.
You had a whole overlay with a suspected robbery, murder, which, of course, was a trauma that I didn't have. I also had 5 years to pretty much get used to what was going on. And I'm an anthropologist, and so I was very happy to let the system take over as a quote-unquote foreigner, not really knowing what the best steps would be and not wanting to offend David's family or the Kampung or my children. I was very, very happy to be able to sit back. I do remember some decisions my mother made when my father died, and my parents were both living will people, and so we never saw the body again. All right? The body was taken to Seattle Memorial University Hospital, and Mom got the ashes, I think, a year after he died, where we finally had an interment of his ashes. Okay. But we had a service in our church, probably 10 days after he died. And to an Islam, to a Muslim, of course, 10 days after he died, because it's done so quickly in Judaism and Islam. But I think we had a memorial service, and our church has turned its view of death from the colors of black and no flowers to the celebration of life. And so it's flowers and gold and it's a laboratory. And that's a change that I think took place maybe in the 60s. But there were ritual too. I mean, it was the Episcopal Church, and it's quite ritualized. And so there were rituals that my mother was aware of. She was 68. She was socially very conscious. And so she also knew about keeping a guest book and making sure every flower, every bowl of spaghetti that was delivered to the house was written down so she could write a thank you letter to everybody who did it. And so she had her own ritual, was, I suppose, family tradition or tradition of her class to follow. And so she followed that at the same time as the Episcopal traditions and this tradition of not having a body because we willed our body to science, which is something, of course, happening more and more as well.
Right, I see. After David died, what happened in terms of your financial and legal situation?
Yeah, we were very, very secure, actually. We had legal and financial security, thank heavens. I can imagine how that would be a real problem for other widows. And if you look on the internet in this topic, there's a lot of discussion about just those particular things. Legally, I was now almost an Indonesian, and so that wasn't really going to be a problem. And thank heavens we didn't have too much financial problem. But the problems weren't there. They were more, now what am I going to do kind of problems. And I decided that I would cut myself some slack and not make any major decisions from May until December. And I said, 2014, I'll start deciding what I want to do. Again, looking back at what my mother did, David died in May. I got a telephone call in June. It was actually before Ampat Puluhari, from my former employers at Panghager asking me to come back to work. And I said, okay. So in September of that year, I became president director of Panghager Hospitality Management. So here were these great ideas that I was not going to do anything or make any major decisions. And all of a sudden, I made a major life career decision. Okay, so much for that kind of stuff. But I think it is important for women to feel that they can cut themselves some space and can suspend major decision making, because in some cases, we're not capable of making good decisions for ourselves at that point.
What would your advice be if they were not in that situation?
Say? Well, one of the things that they said in the literature, if you look on the internet, the internet's flooded with this, and they said that when a man loses a spouse, he remarries.
Right away.
And so he puts his life right back to where it was again with somebody else. When a woman loses a spouse, she tries to find a job because she does need to find her own financial security. And so I guess that's what happens to most people, to most women. Now, we know in Islam particularly, and Muhammad was very kind about orphans and widows, and he took them on his, you know, he took on quite a few brides. Whether he had relations with them is another question, but he apparently, my husband told me, took on orphans and widows in order to protect them from the bad luck of not being secure. You asked me to talk about widowhood in a patriarchal society, and I was trying to think of a society that wasn't patriarchal, and I can't think of one. Yes, we have matrilineals, and but I can't think of a society which is actually not patriarchal. So it's kind of you don't really need to say patriarchal. It has to do with the word society, now women are working and women do have jobs and careers to go back to, which was a good example of what I was invited to come back. I was interested. I don't think Bonhager did it because they were feeling sorry for me, but I think perhaps they thought I was so tied up in my husband's health. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know what they were thinking. Anyway, they asked me to come back, and I did with both feet on and very happy to do it. I'd already been teaching at ITB. I don't think they even knew that David died because they didn't know him particularly. Mm-hmm. So I just kept teaching, and that seemed to be enough.
I guess the question about patriarchal society thing, it's for me more of what if it was a not patriarchal society? What if it was more gender equal, or what if it was a matriarchal society? I suppose the experience or the perception would have been completely different.
I suppose. Yeah, women as slaves, household slaves, or however you want to call it, means that we do work that's unpaid. And I suppose it would depend on how the matriarchal system was set up, or that women got actual physical payment, physical money in order to survive. I don't know. Well, my mother would say, if you've got money, everything is good.
And that's true.
There's no problems. I've just lost a friend, and just recently, and she was a widow. She was a widow quite young, and her mother is sick, and her father just died. And so she's been in Bandung taking care of this. Mm-hmm. And then she died. Mm-hmm. She died 3 months after being told she had cancer. And I was concerned as who was taking care of her affairs, because her mother can't do anything. She herself was handling her father's affairs. So now what? Mm-hmm. And I called a friend of mine and said, you know, we need to go and see, does anybody need help here? Mm-hmm. And then we discovered that actually her in-laws, she was a widow and been a widow for 15 years. Mm-hmm. Her in-laws were the ones who took care of her. I was surprised by it, and I'd like to know more about it, because that is the patriarchal system taking care of her.
Yeah.
How far they take care of her, I don't know. But I'm fascinated by it. It happened just this last week or so. So I've been actually thinking about this topic and rather interested to see that, okay, the patriarchal system is handling my friend. It's not her family that's taking care of things. It's her late husband's family, and he's been gone for 15 years. So apparently there still is a strand that sees his family as responsible. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was as good as that. In looking at, for instance, on the internet for this topic, I was interested, how long are you a widow? I mean, I thought you were a widow until you either remarried or died. But not. If you pay U.S. tax, if you're a U.S. citizen, the IRS calls you a widow for 2 years.
Okay? Oh.
And after that, you're single. You're not a widow anymore, unless you've got dependent children. Okay, now, who made that rule up? And I don't think it was a bunch of women. I think it was a bunch of men who made that rule up. I was interested that there was a time limit on this thing, because I never thought of it as being anything but a state, like you're single forever until you get married. Well, you're a widow if you were married and he died, until you die, unless you remarry. But nope, the U.S. government says 2 years you're a widow, which I thought was rather interesting.
Silly.
Yeah, well, it could be also silly. I don't know why they would say it. I didn't go that far, but I thought that was rather interesting that they made a time limit.
Well, you know, the trend, quote-unquote trend right now, is even after you've remarried, you still had that experience of widowhood.
Of course.
So in a sense, once you're a widow, you're still always a widow. And you're just kind of both.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess it's different.
Yeah, I hear that. Okay. My husband and I had discussed this when his older sister died. And we had a chance to talk about cemeteries and how we wanted to be treated. And so I felt very secure in the last days of his life, that I kind of knew where we were going to be going if we had to go there. But David also told me that he would not give me permission to marry after he died. And I was like, what? How are you going to deny me permission? And he didn't say I'm going to come back and haunt you or anything like this. But he was adamant that I not marry after he died. I haven't felt any impulse to get married, and so I don't need to go there and figure it out. But this was his assertion. I don't think there's anything in Islam about it, or anything Christianity about it, or anything in Sunda about this. But this was his take on it. I told him very not nicely that he had sort of put paid to my ever wanting to be married again. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It was a wonderful experience. I never want to do it twice. But I was older and I had older kids, and so I could probably say that. But yeah, that was his take. I've been struck by, and recently, because we've lost a lot of people in the last 6 months, I've been struck by the bustle that surrounds a funeral. Mm-hmm. And it has to be done so quickly, and it's so well coordinated, but all these things are happening. And after the week is over, mm-hmm. and sometimes even within that week, things stop. Mm-hmm. And I've got several female friends. I have a widow friends now who are very lonely. They seem to have almost been expunged from mm-hmm. society. Now, they're older women, older than I am even. And so I make an attempt to spend time mm-hmm. with them because it seems like we kind of disregard them. And, mm-hmm. and you were right in discussing the idea that there are some experiences like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't have it. I had a lot of friends. I was still 68. I was still working. I maintained a lot of friends and contacts. Mm-hmm. And so that didn't happen to me. Did I have to assert myself? I don't think so. I was working and teaching as I had been. So I didn't think that I had to actually insist on being accepted into mm-hmm. public. But I've heard this. I've heard the story. Mm-hmm. I remember actually the other way around when I was a single woman, I was not easily invited into married women's groups. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so this is kind of the reverse of that, mm-hmm. That you're with married women. Now you lose your spouse and all of a sudden you're not invited anymore. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's just the competition for men that women feel all their lives. That would be interesting to explore.
And maybe we'll explore that in a later episode.
Right.
And that was her unique story and experience. If you would like to share your voice with me, contact me at irineefferin.com. That's AirineEfferin.com. Subscribe for more courageous voices from women all around Southeast Asia.
Is it over now?
Yes.
Because I wanted to say, there are pages and pages on the internet about uh-huh. what to do with your wedding ring.
Uh-huh.
They're seriously discussing this. There's articles talked about seven things to do with your wedding ring. And it's like, my God, people are actually chatting about, what did you do with your wedding ring?
I just put it away. Saved it somewhere. Yeah, well, saved it in a box.
There's lots of things you can do besides put it away.
Oh, yes.
Well,
maybe I'll look at that.
You could have it redesigned. Or you can wear it around your neck. And then you can wear it around your neck with your husband's. Now, it said something about Sheryl Sandberg,
the CEO
of Facebook, wears her ring on the chain. Okay, but the others prefer two wedding bands on a chair. Now, I'm wearing both my parents' wedding rings on here. She gave them to me. This is a major topic on the internet.
Oh, well, thanks for telling me that. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah. And it's bizarre, and I'd be interested in your take on it. I never thought about this dilemma of what to do with my wedding ring or anything else. Mm-hmm. It just didn't crop up in my thinking.
Well, as you know, I'm not a huge fan of rings.
I know you're not, and neither was I.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, it was just, well, I didn't even wear it. Okie didn't wear it when
right.
we were alive.
I didn't wear one. David didn't wear one.
We just keep it there.
Hello. Yeah.
Thanks for staying for the extras.